I want to know about this approximateur that was going on next door. Does that happen in other types of disciplines as well, or just the sopranos?
Well, you know, it's I think it's something that is often applied on and not just singers, but instrumentalists as well.
An official definition of that.
An approximateur is when someone performs a pitch which doesn't have an actual clear pitch center, but it could pass for many different pitches at the same time.
If you have a wide enough vibrato, you can pick your pitch.
That's right. If it's a sixth or a seventh wide, you've got all the pitches in between covered.
You don't expect to find that many people who are looking to take a master class in the lute, but it seems that everywhere you go, there are people hungry to learn about this instrument.
Well, there are lute players really all over the country and all over Western Europe and Japan and Australia and so on. And there are well-established teachers and performers in quite a few major cities, but there are lots of places where there are avid lute players and no teachers around. So whenever there's a masterclass offered, there are a lot of people who are interested in having the opportunity to get some instruction.
So you might actually have more at your masterclasses than, say, if a pianist comes through town or something.
Well, that does happen in some in some instances. I was outside of L.A. a couple of weeks ago, and the masterclass was absolutely packed because they don't have many opportunities to talk about how to perform 16th and 17th century lute music. So it can sometimes be a very, very big, enthusiastic crowd.
And it seems that in the recent, maybe the last 10 years or so, there's been a real explosion in interest in music from this era. And did that come out of the people starting to pay attention to performance practices from the Baroque, and did it just kind of slide backwards from there?
It did. I think that actually it started from all of the musicological work and interest on the part of performers back in the 50s and 60s of trying to recreate performances of medieval music and then Renaissance music. And the interest in historical performances of Baroque music came a little bit later. In fact, the earliest interest was trying to figure out how these medieval and Renaissance instruments sounded, how they were played, what kinds of music they played, how was the music performed, and so on. And it's gradually worked its way forward so that we even have recordings made recently of 20th century music on historical instruments. That is Schoenberg and Stravinsky and Gustav Holst that Kenny Slovak at the Smithsonian has recorded on authentic instruments. That is authentic instruments of the early 20th century using performance practices of that period.
Schoenberg on a lute just does not.
Well, no, not on a lute.
Oh,
but
okay.
These are performances of Schoenberg's music on instruments. You know, violins and flutes and oboes and so on set up the way they were when he wrote the music, which people assume that must be very similar to what is performed today. But in fact, it's in some cases, particularly with reed instruments and in terms of the use of bowed stringed instruments, an approach to sound, an approach to phrasing, an approach to articulation and so on, it's considerably different.
The interesting thing I see in the lute is, first of all, beyond just the sheer different types of instruments, the Baroque lute, and how many instruments did you say you had
at
one point?
I don't know, 25 or something like that.
And they're all slightly different in some way or other.
Well, many of them are radically different because the thing is the lute is not a single instrument, but it was an entire family, and it was an evolving family. So that in the 16th century, for instance, a court would have a whole collection of lutes ranging from medium-sized instruments for all-purpose use to bass instruments for accompanying to double bass lutes and then going right down to very, very small soprano instruments so that they could perform in ensembles and could cover all of the pitches of an ensemble composition. And then there were lutes with gut strings. There were members of the family that used metal strings. There were instruments plucked with the right hand fingers, instruments strummed with a pick of some sort, usually an eagle quill or an ivory plectrum. And then over the course of time, the instruments changed. They experimented with different tunings. They added more strings to the instrument. At one point in the 17th century, there were about 85 different tunings that were used. So in order to play all of the lute music from the 14th century to the end of the 18th century, I once calculated you would need about 150 instruments.
Wow.
To play all of the surviving music. Now, could you play some of that music on another instrument? In other words, could you play music that was composed for a very special kind of lute and play it on a more normal sort of 16th century lute? In some cases, you can. You lose something in the specific color. It's like changing ingredients in a recipe. If you don't have a certain ingredient, there are certain other ingredients you can substitute. You have a different dish that has a slightly different flavor, and within reason, you can make some substitutions. But in other cases, you really have to have the specific instrument the music was written for, or it doesn't work because it requires that specific color.
So you have, in the cases of all these tunings, you have Scordatura Gone Mad, first of all.
Right.
That, to me, as a musician, would be something that would just really mess with my head. Every time the tuning changes.
It would if they had notated the music in standard notation. Because if they had notated the music in standard notation, then you would have to ask yourself the question, looking at the music, now, wait a second, where is A today in this tuning? Hmm. But because lute music was notated in tablature, and tablature tells you where to put your fingers rather than asking you to play a certain pitch, you don't have to ask the question, where is A in this tuning? You simply put your fingers down where the tablature says. If it says to put your finger on the third fret of the second string, you put your finger on the third fret of the second string and you don't worry about what that pitch is. Obviously, when you start analyzing the music to perform it, you want to know harmonically what's going on in the music. But in terms of pure sight reading, this is the most elegant solution, because by notating the music in a system which tells you where to put your fingers, you simply follow instructions and you don't really have to think about what all the pitches are when you're doing it.
So you could put out Lute Hero and be right on top of things, because I've watched kids play this and do the drums, and all you have to do is make sure that the stick goes to the right pad or the fingers go. So Lute Hero would be actually almost performance practice of the day.
That's right. That's right.
You're 21st century music, Paul.
It's what a friend of mine in Slovenia refers to as idiot proof. You know, the tablature system is so beautiful because you just put your fingers where it says and don't ask questions.
And if you ask questions, you're just going to cause trouble.
Well, again, once you become familiar with the piece of music, then you want to go through and analyze it and find out what's happening harmonically, what's happening melodically. But the first time through, you're not worrying about, now, wait a second, that pitch was, the third chorus was an A yesterday, but in this new tuning, it's a B flat. So if I want to finger this chord, you don't worry about that. The person who wrote the music in tablature in the 17th century figured all that out for you.
And when you played music then, if I understand correctly, there was a lot more for the musician to do in terms of how the music developed, because it wasn't, they didn't have every single note and all of this stuff written down. You had to be a very good improviser.
It's very much like a jazz chart, that you get a framework upon which to flesh out a full piece, which will be different every time you perform it. Now, if you're performing in one of the normal tunings that we're accustomed to, that's something that we do all the time. And if somebody decides to play a piece that's in one of these exotic 17th century tunings, then you have to become conversant enough, fluent enough in that tuning in order to start improvising in it.
And when you start looking at that, it takes me back to the very early days of your performance, because normally high school kids, especially in our years, in the 60s and 70s, wanted to be rock guitarists, wanted to be rock and rollers, and all you were trying to do was improve your electric guitar playing. You were working on Hendrix riffs and Clapton riffs, and what happened?
Well, that was a wonderful ploy that a friend of our family's used with me, which was I was playing electric guitar, and he said, you know, you could improve your electric guitar playing if you were to study classical guitar because there is a serious pedagogy involved. And he realized that once I started studying classical guitar, I would get hooked, which I did. And classical guitar led to the lute, and here I am now.
So this was a ploy. This was a – you were set up.
I was set up. It was genius. It was really – he was an evil genius, and it worked.
My understanding, too, is – and I'd like you, since we're in Columbus, Ohio, to relate the story about not long after you started playing classical guitar, you found yourself in a competition also not necessarily of your own choosing.
That's right. Evan Whalen, the then conductor of the Columbus Symphony, was a friend of my parents, and we were at some social event with him, and I had just started studying classical guitar and had become quite enthusiastic about it and became familiar with the concerto repertory for the classical guitar and orchestra. And I approached Evan and I said, boy, it would be great if the Columbus Symphony could do a guitar concerto. There are these wonderful concertos that would really add richness and special character to the programming for the season. And he said, oh, why don't you play a concerto with the orchestra? I understand you're studying the classical guitar now. And I said, yes, but I've only been studying for about 2 months. And he said, well, we have a young musicians competition coming up. Why don't you enter that and play a guitar concerto? And the prize is if you win, you get to play a guitar concerto with the Columbus Symphony. And I said, but I don't have a concerto in my repertoire. I only just started playing the instrument, so a concerto will be too difficult. He said, well, you can enter next year as well, but why don't you do it this year for the experience? So I went home and talked to my parents about it, and we got a hold of music for Vivaldi D major concerto that was originally written for the lute. And I practiced that for a couple of weeks and entered the competition, and I didn't think I played very well. We were kind of laughing about that, the short notice of this, and having studied classical guitar at that point 3 months, whereas some of the pianists had been working on their Mozart concerto for over a year for the competition. When the phone rang and they said, congratulations, you are the winner of the Columbus Symphony's Young Musicians Competition. You will be playing the Vivaldi D major concerto at a concert with the Columbus Symphony.
That had to really irritate some of those other players. They've spent their entire lives getting ready, and you just come in and say, oh, okay. I would be completely flabbergasted and a little bit hacked off.
Well, I think it's all about electric guitar. I think that playing the electric guitar, and I mean this seriously, was a fantastic advantage because since we all, in learning how to play the electric guitar, learned by copying Hendrix and Clapton and all the great players of the 60s, and learned all of their riffs off of recordings, practicing over and over and over again, and acquired a repertoire of riffs which we could then apply improvising differently night after night, I think that gave a very firm basis and a comfort level with improvising and playing in a spontaneous way. I know so many musicians, especially in the early music world, who were rock musicians when they were teenagers. I think that there is a logical connection there, which makes a lot of sense pedagogically. And the mentality. I know teaching at the Eastman School of Music, when you come across someone playing a Mozart piano sonata and you suggest that they might ornament the repeat of a certain section, they look at you as if you're expecting something completely unreasonable. You don't want me to change the notes on the page that Mozart wrote down. No, I want you to do what Mozart would do, which is to use the notes on the page as a starting point and then elaborate on that. And they look at you as if you have four heads. You know, what are you asking us to do? But in fact, that's exactly the mentality of the time, that you never play things the same way twice, and you're always adding to every piece that you play in a historically appropriate way.
Well, there was a conductor some years ago that put out the, you know, what's so great about Mozart's Jupiter Symphony? What's so great about Eine kleine Nachtmusik? And he said, if you listen to this phrase, and he'd play it, and then you listen to the phrase where you think he's repeating the phrase, he's not completely repeating the phrase. There's a little this or a little that, and even the things he wrote down were not identical. So that makes perfect sense, but there are so many music teachers that say, you know, this was written by so-and-so, and who are you to mess with what's on the page?
Yeah, well, that's just a complete misunderstanding of the musical mentality, the musical literacy of someone from the 17th or 18th centuries, that the notes on the page were simply a quick and dirty way of getting the basics down. But the details of performance were left up to the performers. And that continued right into the 20th century. If you listen to these piano rolls of Rachmaninoff playing his own piano music, he plays a certain harmony, and then he plays arpeggios or roulades to get to the next harmony. And those two harmonies, points A and B, are the same as in the printed music. But the individual notes of how to get from point A to point B are completely different. And the reason is he was improvising, so it was different every time he played. And at a certain point, the publisher said, here, publish. And so he wrote down a certain version, which is, of course, the exact notes that every performer who plays that music performs from that point on. But that really goes completely against the spirit and the character of the music, which is that they said about performances of opera in the 18th century, if you have a singer who has memorized a certain version of an aria and does the same thing every night, you've heard everything you need to hear after one performance. But the really great musicians are the people who improvise something differently every single time they perform it. And then you have to go to all 27 performances of a run of an opera because you know that the singers are going to do something differently every single night. Therefore, you are experiencing something different each time. The people who memorized a version of a piece and repeated that over and over again were considered inferior musicians during the Baroque era and before, certainly in the 16th century as well. The real musicians were the people who were making things up on the spot. Obviously in a highly expressive and interesting and inventive way, because improvisation can be like everything else in life. It comes in good, bad, and indifferent, and life-changing. And it depends on the skill of the improviser as to which category the improvisation fits into.
Which might explain some of the musicians or some of the composers we have today who are contemporaries of Vivaldi or Telemann or Rameau or whomever, who are not as well known, but apparently from what you read were very well respected, and maybe for that very reason, because what they did in performance was masterful, even if what they wrote down wasn't all that exciting.
Well, there's so many examples of that. One that often occurs to me is that if you look at the vocal music of Monteverdi with these absolutely magnificent, elaborate ornamental passages, sometimes involving two and three singers at the same time, and you compare that to music of his contemporaries, which is much simpler on the page, you would conclude, well, Monteverdi is brilliant, and somebody like Grandi or Rovetta are obviously less sophisticated composers. But then if you look at the treatises on how the music was performed and you see what a performer was expected to do with a whole note or with a series of quarter notes and the sorts of ornamental passages that they were expected to turn those simple notes into, it ends up looking like the complex vocal music of Monteverdi. So if you perform music by Grandi or Rovetta exactly as it is on the page, it definitely does not sound as inspired as Monteverdi. But if you add the kind of improvised ornaments that were expected of performers in that time, the music ends up being as brilliant as Monteverdi. And then you understand why these people were so highly regarded in their time. So it was really performers' music. And to a certain extent, people today have gravitated towards music in which the most details have been written down in the music. Mm-hmm. You know, in the 18th century, Bach was highly criticized by contemporaries because of his writing out ornamentation that was expected that performers would add. And performers complained. They said, we can't read this music. What is this music that has how many bars are on these 128th notes, 64th notes, 32nd notes? They had no idea how to read note values that small. Of course, they played them all the time because they were improvising them. And somebody said, yes, but Bach has a right to notate these kinds of details to prevent tasteless performers from improvising in a way that would reflect badly on the composer. But I think it's not an accident that the music of the 17th and 18th centuries that is the most widely acclaimed today is that in which the most details of performance are notated. And it's not an accurate reflection of the quality of the music of other composers.
So the music we hear today that we're not hearing today is as much because we don't have the musicians who understand what to do with it, and therefore we as listeners and music lovers really have no way to appreciate what these people could do.
That's absolutely right.
Have you ever considered or do you ever pick up an electric guitar anymore?
I haven't played an electric guitar in, I don't know, 35 years, something like that.
Have you ever tried any Hendrix on a lute?
I have been known from time to time in concert to slip in the odd little blues improvisation.
We need to get that. We need you to do we get all along the Watchtower, or we need to hear you break into Cocaine by Clapton. We need something because I think and Chaz Weatherby from the Columbus Symphony made a very interesting comment about this. He started doing things like that because he said, I'm asking these kids to come into my world and step into my world a little bit. So I feel like maybe it's incumbent upon me to step into theirs. So those blues licks may be doing more than you think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Paul, I appreciate your time. It's good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.